Coming up, renowned writer and editor Judy Gruen talks about bylines and blessings. Welcome to 613 Books Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Dean. And if you like to read a variety of books with authentic Jewish values, we read you loud and clear. My guest on this episode of 613 Books Podcast is Judy Gruen. Judy says that she writes to find meaning, hope, and laughter in a complicated world. She has published two memoirs. The newest one is Bylines and Blessings, and also one that you're probably familiar with called The Skeptic and the Rabbi, as well as three humor books, one of which is a multiple award winner. Judy is also a columnist with The Jewish Journal, and her essays and features have appeared in many publications, such as Jewish Action, The Wall Street Journal, New York Daily News, Chicago Tribune, and on H.com, and many other outlets. Welcome, Judy Gruen, to 613 Books Podcast.
Thank you, Heather. It's great to be here.
Thank you for speaking with us. I want to start off with talking about something on your website. On your website, you say that you wanted to be the next Irma Bombeck, only Jewish. Now, I remember Irma Bombeck's syndicated newspaper humor pieces because my mother would clip her favorites from the newspaper and stick them to the wall of a den that was off our kitchen. And with a household name like Irma Bombeck, she demonstrated that a woman could write humorous pieces and be paid to do so. I'm just wondering, were you always funny? Did you know you were funny from the reactions of other people?
One of my grandfathers, my paternal grandfather, was a practical joker. Not everybody thought that his practical jokes were so funny, that sometimes they bordered on the inappropriate, let's say, but he was funny. And from very young age, 5, 6 years old, I liked to imitate people. And I felt very free to do so, not friends or family, but characters on TV. And I remember watching my mother crack up. So, you know, a little kid gets a great reaction from an adult, especially a parent. It encourages you to do more. And Irma Bombeck was a big presence in our lives too. And my mother would read her and laugh. And from the time that I could read her columns, even from, you know, 8, 9 years old, I would tear open the paper 3 times a week. And I just absorbed it. I loved it. I don't know. She just did something for me. So she really was a mentor for me. I don't know why I felt such a connection to her when she was my mother's age and I was so young, but there it was. It was just there. And a few times I went to the Irma Bombeck Writers Conference at the University of Dayton, which was her alma mater. It is a Catholic university. She was Catholic. And there's a famous story that she told that's on video that they showed us at the conference, which was that she showed one of her first pieces of humor writing to one of the instructors there who was Father somebody, Father Tim. And he looked at her after he read it and he said, "You can write." Mm-hmm. And she said those words changed her life.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm wondering, did somebody tell you that at an early age? You can write.
I was drawn to writing again from my earliest years. And I was also hopeless failure at math and science. Numbers, even simple math, eluded me. I was very embarrassed by it. My mom needed to hire a tutor for me, even for basic subtraction. So I think it made me glom on more tightly, even to writing, because I knew I could do that. And I hoped that I wouldn't have to, you know, struggle with math or science. And I did struggle. We didn't get along, numbers and me. But words I got. Words I could put together and rearrange and all of that. But when it came to math and science, I was just no good at it. So I was encouraged because I did seem to have something there. Obviously, it was something that needed to be built up. And I feel that I'm still building it up all these decades later.
Right, I hear. You know, before I go on to the next thing on my mind to ask you, I just feel I have to ask you if you could give us an example of one of your grandpa's practical jokes, something that's G-rated enough you can share with us.
Yes, a famous family story. I think I mentioned this incident in my previous memoir, The Skeptic and the Rabbi, because my grandparents, both sets, one was religious and one was very irreligious. He was the irreligious one. They have been such formative presences in my life, and even now when they've been gone for so long. But one of his most notorious pranks was that he and my grandmother had been invited to dinner in a very elegant home. I think they ran in some high circles. And he had brought along with him a whole bunch of antacids and over-the-counter remedies for stomach upset. And along the gleaming table, he distributed various stomach remedies. And when the hostess came in and saw, I don't know what she did, but they were never invited back. Now, he thought it was hilarious. I don't think my grandmother spoke to him in a month after that. That's one example.
Yeah, that's a memorable one. I can see how it's part of your family lore. In your case, as a budding writer, you had a particularly interesting entry-level job, including writing for a magazine called Hospital Gift Shop Management. As I'm reading about this, I'm just thinking, talk about niche, right? You took this job seriously, and you proved to be a solid writer, and eventually, you got the opportunity to edit an article, and let's just say that episode didn't work out as well as you hoped. Your boss told you, Judy, you're a good writer, but you'll never be an editor. So I'm just wondering, maybe you would please read some of your afterthoughts that you had about that poor feedback. It's from your book, starting at the bottom of page 39, when you took stock of what you thought a good writer does and what happened later.
Yes, I'm happy to read that. I just do want to say that when I showed up for the interview for that job, that first job after college, I didn't know what the magazine was. I just heard there's some new trade magazine starting. It was a friend told me about, you know, getting in touch with the publisher. And when she told me the name of the magazine, I just stared blankly, like, what? I didn't know about trade magazines. Trade magazines as distinct from consumer magazines. Right. But I did learn a lot about retailing. So anyway, here's what happened after my boss told me that I was a good writer, but I'd never be an editor. I believe that a good writer nurtures her love and respect for the written word and understands the ingredients of prose that flows logically and at times lyrically. A good writer is committed to the practice of writing as an art and a craft. I believed an understanding of the elements of style that comprise effective, articulate, affecting writing was a completely transferable skill to the craft of editing. Perhaps this wasn't necessarily true for all other writers, but I felt a fiery determination that it would be true for me. Carol was my employer and my mentor, but I would prove her wrong. A few weeks after this meeting, I asked Carol to let me try editing again. In the interim, I had scrutinized my writing with greater care, remembering the lessons she taught me during what had been a sobering tutorial. This time, she was pleased with the results, and a few months later, she promoted me from staff writer to assistant editor.
Yay! So you won the day. A lot of hard work. A lot of hard work and a lot of just adjusting your attitude. The book shows you have a very strong personality, which I think is a very good influence for your readership, that you are very perseverant, right? That's always served you well.
I think that anybody who has a goal that they have a fiery determination to achieve, you have to be strong. You can't let the setbacks keep you back. And this book is filled with stories of early and not so early setbacks even in relatively recent years. But I never let it stop me. You know, you just can't let things stop you. If you know that you're meant to do something, if you love it, if you see that there's value in it, you just keep going. And I feel that that's a particularly important message now because not to paint too broad brushstroke, but we've just heard and see patterns with young people today that they are so easily discouraged, overly sensitive, and they've been done a disservice to the adults who overly coddled them. That's not a favor. It doesn't build them.
Right. And I think that in your case, being so determined, one of the parts of your journey as a journalist includes when you had an idea to at least apply and then enroll in a solid school of journalism. And the one you went to is often the aspiration of many serious journalists, aspiring journalists, and that's Northwestern. And, you know, when you enrolled in Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, you had a good amount of professional experience with the publication. But this would prove to be an eye-opening experience, especially when there were debates over what is called, and I quote, the public's right to know. There were students who argued, for example, in favor of a photo from the scene of a car accident. So maybe you would tell us the reason why a photo from a car accident was particularly unnerving for you. And if you could follow up your answer by reading the paragraph, which starts at the bottom of page 62.
Yes. First of all, when I started Northwestern at the Medill School of Journalism, I had about 3 years of professional writing experience. A lot of the students were fresh out of college and they were very exuberant. And actually, so was I. I was still very exuberant. But I saw that they had kind of bought into a certain romantic idealization of what it meant to be a reporter and just going gung-ho. And during that class, when the professor showed a big picture from, I don't know whether it was the Tribune or the other paper, but it was of a car accident and a sheet over a gurney. And so many of the students said, yes, yes, the public has a right to know. Yes, I would publish that. But this was personal for me because our family suffered a terrible tragedy when I was 9 years old and my 17-year-old brother died in a car accident that day. I wrote about that. Well, I write about it a little bit here. And I just was frozen and almost shaking in my seat because I was just picturing what would that have done to my family to see a photo like that? Why did the public have a right to see a photo like that? I remember that there was an in memoriam article about my brother in a small weekly paper, not like the LA Times or anything like that, that showed his high school senior photo where he was, you know, handsome and dressed in a suit and tie. That was nice. But to have needlessly rubbed salt in the wound, there was no public service involved in that. Mm-hmm. And these are the thoughts that I had about this situation as I write in the book. Journalism is a craft. For the especially talented and industrious, it can become an art, but it is not a science and never can be. The media create and shape messages through the stories they choose to cover and which they choose to ignore. They also angle their stories by selecting whom to interview, therefore providing a platform for cherry-picked views and whom they avoid questioning, not wanting to share their perspectives. Stories are shaped and molded in myriad ways, including the images they publish, the pull quotes in large type, the headlines with biases baked in. Most people drawn to journalism are idealistic, pulled toward this career because we want our writing to have impact. Political and social biases in journalism were as old as journalism itself, but these biases were increasingly and unapologetically on display and driving the media agenda. More and more, this agenda took precedence against the ideal of aiming for objectivity, impossible as this was to achieve. That's the end of that paragraph. That kind of leads into a bigger, even a bigger topic about the political bias. But the point about this whole episode was, I think that reporters need to be to stop and ask themselves who really benefits if this is published.
Right.
And who would be harmed.
Yes, got it. Judy, you wrote extensively about Jeff, your husband, whom you met in California and began dating. And Frank talks about Jewish observance and upholding certain Jewish laws before the two of you got married were also common occurrence. There is so much more that you write about your relationship, but I'd like to ask you what you consider the easiest and also the most challenging thing about writing about your relationship with him.
When you write about personal relationships, and particularly one as fundamental and as intimate as marriage, you know, it's tricky. One of the chapters I have in this book is called Boundaries. It's a short chapter, and in it I discuss the decisions that writers have to make about where do they draw the line in terms of personal boundaries for themselves and other people they're writing about. Because if you're writing about your own life, you're not only writing about your own life unless you live in, you know, some isolated cabin somewhere. You're writing about other people and you need to be careful. So to get back to your question more specifically, writing about us and our relationship was never easy because I was always weighing what needs to be said, what will convey this idea, what will convey this growth in our relationship or the static in our relationship. So those are all very careful decisions. And of course, he always reads everything before I publish it if it involves him. And of course, he's always been my biggest cheerleader. So he read this entire manuscript before as well. And the easy part of it, even though writing is never easy, was that I owe it to him that he was so patient with me. We dated for such a long time when I was just fighting and fighting this whole idea of orthodoxy and being, you know, Shomer Shabbos and Kashrut and all of that. And I was fighting. But I saw that I couldn't not see that there was value in it, especially as I started seeing people who had also made that choice. And they were living pretty good lives. When I say pretty good lives, I mean they seemed wholesome. And they had what I wanted. They had solid marriages. They had cute little children who were living in a beautiful framework. And even though this was, I'm going back 35 years, even then you could see there were so many changes in society that I saw were unhealthy and things were becoming less and less stable in family life. So from that standpoint, writing about our discussions and our debates was easy. I don't think that there was anything particularly difficult because I was not writing about our marriage dynamics. It wasn't appropriate, wasn't relevant. That would have been really, really difficult. I do also mention Jeff and our relationship in a later chapter, Follow the Blessing, when I was kind of ragging on my frustrations with this field, particularly what I considered a lack of professional success for myself that I had always wanted, which it doesn't really happen so well in Jewish journalism, right, Heather? But that has so many other rewards. And Jeff and I would have this discussion over and over again. And he would say, look, your work has real impact. You're affecting people's thoughts and their feelings. You're even changing people's lives. I'm just running a business. And we'd have the same argument. And I'd say, you're not just running a business. You're such a mensch. You're honest. You're professional. And in a time when these kinds of old-fashioned virtues were less and less readily apparent or less common, I said, you are a Kiddush Hashem. You know, you're an inspiration for people, not to mention the fact that you are providing a valuable, you know, service and product for people.
Very nice. Very nice. So around the time that you wrote the Women's Daily Irony Supplement, you sent the coffee company Starbucks a quote for their The Way I See It, limited collection of cups. So if you could tell us the quote, you'll find it on page 123. And also tell us about an irate Starbucks customer who yelled at you for seemingly walking off with a bunch of their cups.
Oh, that was funny. So here's the quote. They had invited me to submit 3 quotes, and I didn't think they were going to pick me. You know, I had no name recognition, but not everybody was famous. Some people were, but they picked this one, and here it is. Have you noticed that dogs are the new kids? You take a walk with your kid and your dog, but nobody says, "What a cute kid." Instead, they say, "What a cute dog. What's his name? Is he a rescue?" Maybe if I put a collar and leash on my kid, someone will notice her.
Very cute. That's fun. That's fun. And so the cup gets printed, and then what happens?
Okay, so I didn't realize at first that once they published this, that they wouldn't be in all the Starbucks. And I had a speaking engagement. It was one of my disasters. I write about it in here. God, one of the worst nights of my professional life. I almost needed heavy sedation after that. But I found the cup at a Starbucks way out in Calabasas, California, which happened to be near where I was speaking in a gated community, which I didn't realize how wealthy this group was, and that my jokes about women who spent, you know, $3,000 on a purse, that they were not going to find that funny at all. But anyway, I ran in. I wanted these cups. I was going to take them all. I wanted a few of them. And I asked the barista, you know, "Do you have this cup?" And they said, "Here it is." So I said, "May I take, you know, 6 of them?" Because I'm Judy Gruen. And one of the customers was watching all this. And he says, "You're Judy Green? This is your cup? I mean, are you kidding me?" And he just started ragging on me. And I just grabbed the cups. I said, "Yes, I'm Judy Gruen. And yeah, this is my quote. And I've got to go. Bye." It was so funny. It was, well, why did he even care? But it was a harbinger of the next few hours and the disasters.
And you lived to tell the tale. Was it more than just making jokes about high-priced items in front of a wealthy crowd?
Yeah, I don't know why. I had done public speaking before, and I had spoken in front of hundreds of people, and it had been great. But for some reason, I had a lot of high hopes pinned on this group. I had even hired a videographer, and I had worked very hard on my presentation, which I had typed up. That was the last time that I ever made a presentation based on something that I needed to read. I was not ready to pivot. I was not ready to just see this isn't working. Move along. And the group was just, I don't know, they were Botoxed beyond smile. You know, they just couldn't move that jaw. And they were just rude. They weren't nice. It was really self-immolation. I had 2 friends with me, and they kept looking at me and nodding like, you know, keep going, keep going. But it was truly a disaster. But from disaster, I very important lesson, and never ever again did I do public speaking that way. And they've all gone so much better. And I also learned you really need to know your audience before you address them. I didn't know really how rich and snobby they were. Not that anyone would say, "Oh, come and speak to our group. We're very rich and snobby. You know, you'll love us." But if I had done maybe a little bit more research, I certainly would have not made fun of the coach purses and all of that.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, you know, I guess when you think of the whole range of all of the speaking engagements, there's got to be a spectrum, right? You already have your worst. And so, you know, that's that point on the spectrum. It can only get better.
Exactly.
So you've really made your mark writing about so many different topics and so many different tones. But you are solidly recognized as a preeminent humor writer in the Jewish space. And I'm wondering, with the world becoming a more chaotic and brutal place to live every day, especially since October 7th, 2023, how have world events, even crazy local events, informed your writing humor pieces?
This is such a great question. Just yesterday, I was following up with another writer, podcaster in Israel who had requested the book, who had interviewed me and had me on her show when my previous book, The Skeptic and the Rabbi, came out. Just following up if she had had a chance to read it and was she still interested. And she said, I started reading the book. It's very well written, but I'm not going to keep reading it. I can't read it. I'm not going to have you on my show. I can't read a book like this that is full of the word I, when everything right now in Israel is about we. And I just can't. And so she said, it's understandable. It's a memoir, but I just can't deal with it. So I wrote her back and I said, I really understand. You're not the first writer in Israel who's told me that. I really understand. Here in the United States, I am finding, though, that people need the humor. They need a little bit of a lift. And I'm sure that it's true in Israel, too. I totally respected what she said and why she said it. And she actually then wrote back and apologized. And she said, I didn't mean to come across that way. She said, but, you know, this is just too raw right now. And I said, it's really okay. I write in Bylines and Blessings about what happened after 9/11, when, ironically, I had had my very first major speaking engagement scheduled after the publication of my first book. Obviously, there was no speaking engagement that night.
Yes.
And I was really in a crisis because I just published my first humor book. My mother had just died, and I was distraught on both levels. And I went to speak to my rabbi, and I said, you know, maybe I shouldn't be just writing humor. Maybe I should be using my abilities and writing serious things on behalf of the Jewish people, which I was still doing. I was never only a humor writer. I was wrote about healthcare. I wrote about psychology, a lot of things. And he said, absolutely not. He said, we need to laugh. Mm-hmm. We need your work. Keep going. And I had also heard unexpectedly from a woman who had read a piece of mine in Women's Day magazine while she was in a doctor's waiting room. She had a very bad prognosis. She was really in a bad way. And it was an excerpt from my book, and it was funny. And she said that she laughed and laughed, and she said, I'll never forget this. She said, you saved my life.
Wow.
I was so shocked. I'm still shocked all these years later when I recall. Now, of course, I didn't save her life. I did nothing even close. But the fact that she perceived laughter as having been so healing, that stayed with me. That just really stayed with me. And I had mentioned that my brother's tragic death when he was so young. And for my mother and me, I spent a lot of time with my mother. I had my father in the picture too, and an older sister, but my mom and I spent a lot of time together. And we sat, I don't know what night it was on, but the odd couple and laughing. I'm dating myself. Well, I'm 63. Okay, it's out there. But we watched these funny shows, and we needed the laughter. Laughter is cathartic. And as I've often written, it is not a luxury, humor. It is a life tool. And I really believe that. And in fact, I have a Substack newsletter. It's under my name or Bylines and Blessings. And I noticed, because they give you stats, that the humor pieces that I was publishing recently had much more engagement than that were more just basically reflective. And so I'm leaning into that more Davka, because there are so many people who are writing very important things about our situation in Israel and for Jews worldwide with anti-Semitism. But people need a break. There's only so much you can absorb that's serious and scary.
Amazing. Amazing. I really appreciate that you tell us what that was also like for you personally and professionally. This has been such a pleasure. I could go on and on talking with you. But for now, we will just end it here with such big thanks, Judy Gruen, for joining me on 613 Books Podcast.
It's really been an honor and a pleasure. I've followed your work for a long time, and I admire what you're doing, and I respect your own work as a journalist, longtime journalist. So it's a pleasure and an honor for me. Thank you so much.
Judy Gruen doesn't just write books. She edits them. Among these are Rabbi Gershon Schusterman's Why, God, Why, which was profiled on this podcast when my interview with Rabbi Schusterman aired in November of 2023. to contact Judy Gruen or to purchase your copy of Bylines and Blessings, head over to the show notes for this week's episode. We also have a link for you over there to read an excerpt from Bylines and Blessings. And that's what's on the shelf for this episode of 613 Books Podcast. I'm Heather Dean. Thanks for listening.
613 Books Podcast is produced and hosted by Heather Dean. Senior producer and director of operations, Greg Cohen. Consulting producer, Yiska Roth. Show announcer, Michael Doniger. Remember to like and subscribe to our show on your favorite app, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your own preferred app, and never miss an episode. You can find all episodes of 613 Books Podcast by visiting our website, heatherdeanproductions.com.